there is an overlap between theological questions and claims and political questions and claims. And the common ground for me is human flourishing, and what are human beings for, and what is the ground of our hope, and what do we want our future to be, and what towards what do we point? We're talking today with Dr. Brandon Edwards, co-director of the S1 Project. He and I are in the midst of having a series of conversations for the What in God's Name podcast about the class that Brandon is teaching at the University of Virginia this fall, Religion in the Public Square. Today we're going to talk about week 3 of the course. The first 2 weeks were week 1. Brandon asked his students, what is the public square and what ails it? And then week 2 was looking at the law, some case law. Those were Supreme Court cases, right, Brandon?
That's correct. Yep.
Supreme Court cases, and then really having to do with the First Amendment, the free expression of religion, and also the establishment, the prohibition of the establishment of religion by the government. So today, we're into week 3 of the course. And Brandon, help us understand week 3. What was the main topic? What did the students read? And tell us about it.
Great. Well, first of all, always a pleasure to be with you, Chris. Glad to be here today and an opportunity to talk about the course because it's something that I feel really excited about. And I appreciate also the recap of sort of the arc of the course so far. And you did a really good job with that. And just to sort of build on where you were, we ended the second week by really grappling with the question of what do our founding documents have to say about the role of religion in society? And then what does the law that builds upon those founding documents through the Supreme Court have to say about it? And where we sort of ended up is the conclusion that this wall of separation that we sort of hear bandied about in public dialogue between church and state, I think the conclusion to which we came is that it's more of a chain link fence than a brick wall, meaning that essentially in some of these cases, religion is certainly barred, for example, from public schools in certain ways. But in other ways, religion is still very much a part of public life, like we see in the case that the students read, The Town of Greece versus Galloway, a 2014 case, which essentially allows for public prayer before the beginning of legislative meetings. And there are a variety of reasons for that. But the more important thing that we take up in week 3 is, if this is really a chain link fence and not a brick wall, then we have to ask ourselves a normative question, a normative philosophical question, which essentially is, what should be the role of religion in a democratic society, in the public square? And that's a philosophical question, as I say. And so what I had the students do is read 2 short pieces, one from Richard Rorty called Religion as a Conversation Stopper, and then Jeffrey Stout, who wrote Democracy and Tradition, in chapter 3, a whole section of that book and that chapter is devoted to dialoguing with Richard Rorty about this topic. Why must religion be a conversation stopper? And I also had them read a piece from Stuart Rosenbaum that basically tries to make heads or tails of this debate. And one of the things I actually want to start by saying is that this was really hard for the students. As a reminder, these are first-year students who've just walked onto UVA's grounds, you know, less than a month ago. And I'm asking them essentially to read some pretty dense philosophical text. So one of the things that we should talk about is, how did I do this successfully? Because that was a lot of fun for me. And for them too, I think.
I want to hear the answer to that question, because you've set it up beautifully, provocatively. I love reading Rorty and Stout, but I've got a long background of training and reading this kind of material. So what magic pixie dust did you spread into the room that allowed or encouraged or somehow made possible these students to read this really rich and dense material.
So pixie dust. So the very first thing that I want to point out is that, and this is a change for me because I've been working with graduate students most recently, and it's been a while since I've taught undergraduates specifically. And one of the pieces of advice that I got was, this age group is much more comfortable watching and listening, and that reading is something that they were probably going to find a bit difficult. So one of the first things that I actually did is I sort of foregrounded that I think reading is an essential skill for an educated person. And so I said, you know, what I really want you to do more than anything else is just give it a shot. And I also showed them how to take notes. I had them do a close reading exercise where I isolated just a few paragraphs and had them read them closely in class with a group of people. But before they even did that, I gave them some important questions. For example, who even is Richard Rorty and who even is Jeffrey Stout? So that they get a sense of not only what does this text have to say, but who are these individuals? What are the traditions from which they come, and what is their educational background, and are they religious? Are they not religious? And how do these things influence how they write about this topic? So that was the first thing that I did.
Did you give them that information, or did you ask them to find it out?
I asked them to find it out because I said that any good reader should be able to go back and find out who the author is and essentially what their perspective is, because that influences who they are, and that's a good skill to practice. So they had to find it out.
They had to find it out. And if I were to find it out, I would use Google. How did they find it out?
I had them go to Wikipedia, actually. And I also had them realize that Richard Rorty and Jeffrey Stout know one another. I mean, these people are friends. So this is a dialogue that is between friends. And I think that was another important aspect of this, because once they realize this, they realize on sort of a bigger level that in fact Rorty and Stout are an example of how we talk about religion in the public square. And that's kind of a beautiful moment. But to go back to the question about the pixie dust, I essentially isolated a few paragraphs for them, as I said. We read them very closely together, and then we talked about the key issues which emerged from that. And I had the students sort of illustrate those points, and we can talk about those in our conversation.
So one of the things you did was have them do that in class so that they would be able to get immediate feedback on how well they were reading some pretty dense stuff. So I would imagine, I mean, just as a teaching strategy, we're kind of talking teaching strategy now. I mean, that's a way to develop some confidence.
That's correct. So part of it, and I'm really big on giving students the opportunity to speak with one another before they speak in a large group for two reasons. One of which is I find that sometimes large group discussions can be really tough for students who are brand new to the university setting. It can seem really intimidating, but if we warm them up first, they are much more likely to share. But the other, I think, is even more important, which is that I think when grappling with certain texts like Rorty and Stout, the ideas that come out of those can be really half-baked, but once they bounce them off of one another, they help each other refine and sharpen the ideas so that when we do come to that large group discussion, I'm almost always bowled over by how really insightful the students are when they come to discussing these issues.
So for you, the teaching strategy is having them share in a small group first, and that then allows, when the full group is together, a deeper and richer conversation there.
Yes, and it also allows for disagreement too, which I think is another sort of learning goal of this class, is to or disagreement with the authors at large. The other thing to that last point, once they begin to make heads or tails of these readings, the part of the conversation that gets them most excited is, do you agree with this? I don't think he's right about this. And so they end up personalizing it. And I think that is another real advantage to doing it this way.
Yeah. So let's get into the content here. Richard Rorty is an advocate for keeping religious talk private, that it should not be in public conversations because by its very nature, religious talk, religious language is a conversation stopper. I mean, that's his he uses that phrase, right? Conversations. It's a conversation stopper.
Yes. So let's talk about what we unearthed in the session. There are a few key points for our listening audience that the students generated from our close read regarding Rorty. The first is essentially that Rorty is a big believer in the Jeffersonian Compromise. And by the way, as a reminder, the students read about the Jeffersonian Compromise with the letter to the Danbury Baptists in week two. So they're familiar with this at this point too. And Rorty's big point here is that there is a kind of contract between the state and religious folks. And he believes, as he thinks Thomas Jefferson believed, essentially that religion should remain private in exchange for people having religious liberty. And so he goes on to say that in his experience, and it's actually not his phrase, it's actually Stephen Carter's phrase. So he is essentially dialoguing with Stephen Carter, who's written this interesting book about where religion should belong in the public square. And for the listening audience, Stephen Carter believes that it belongs in the public square. And Rorty essentially says he believes, however, that Carter is right about one thing, and I'll quote here. He says, Carter is right when he says, one good way to end a conversation or to start an argument is to tell a group of well-educated professionals that you hold a political position, preferably a controversial one, such as being against abortion or pornography, because it is required by your understanding of God's will. I want to hover over this point for a minute because this is a very famous concept, religion as a conversation stopper. And what he essentially says is that when a religion appears as a faith claim, that it does stop conversation. The students in class essentially land on this and say, well, if I'm in a conversation with someone about the abortion debate, reproductive rights, and you say to me, I don't believe that abortion is morally right because it's God's will, well, that's not really a very valid claim because it does shut it down, because either I don't believe in God, therefore I don't really see your perspective and don't validate it, and you don't really want to talk to me because you're appealing to God and there's no way that we can even talk about this any further. So it does illustrate the fact that religion can be a conversation stopper. But as I said, in the next passage, he does leave a little bit of room. He's again sort of drawing from Carter, and he says, the best parts of his very thoughtful and often persuasive book are those in which he points up the inconsistency of our behavior, and by our, he's referring to what he calls liberal philosophers, and the hypocrisy involved in saying that believers somehow have no right to base their political views on their religious faith, whereas we atheists have every right to base ours on Enlightenment philosophy. That claim, the claim that in doing so we are appealing to reason, whereas the religious are being irrational, is hokum, and Carter is right to debunk it. And so the students point out there's this slight nuance here. Maybe there's some version of religion that doesn't belong in the public square, according to Rorty, but maybe he's leaving a door for some of it. So I'll stop there for us to have a little conversation.
If someone says, I'm against abortion, and abortion ought to be outlawed because God says so, that is a religious claim that's being offered in the public square. And it's accurate to describe that as a conversation stopper. And the failure there is not that it's religion in the public square. The failure is that it's a simplistic theological claim. There's no, like, as you were speaking, I was thinking, okay, where, like, if you're a Christian arguing that, what authority would you point to that would back up your claim that God is opposed? There's not a lot in Scripture, and some Old Testament scripture about abortion is inconclusive. The history of the teaching of the church is not monolithic. That has evolved over time. So the criticism I would make of the statement is not that it's religious, but that it's It's not deep enough. It's not theologically grounded enough. If you're going to give reasons from theological perspectives, you've got to be willing to think a little bit more deeply about your theological perspectives. That's what I would say.
So a couple points. I actually think that you and Rorty and Stout all agree on this. And by the way, so do my students. This is why I read that second passage from Rorty, because Rorty seems to suggest that it really is inconsistent, if not downright hypocritical, to say that your Enlightenment philosophy can be given as reason, but religious reason cannot be given as why someone holds a particular claim. So he's leaving that gap. And to bring Jeffrey Stout into this, what Jeffrey Stout calls these are essentially faith claims. So essentially, the way that Stout describes a faith claim is when somebody essentially says, here's my reason for this. This is what scripture or what God says. End of conversation. There's no real reason given behind it. And this is where the students really latch on. Several of them really liked Stout because they like this particular suggestion that he makes toward the end of this section of chapter 3, where he essentially says, most conversations that might involve religion in the public square, when we might be talking about public issues or public policy, at some point are going to lead to an impasse. What we need to do, if they lead to an impasse, is we need to back up a step or two or three and try to come back to the conversation using reason. And I think that's what you're sort of latching onto. The issue is not bringing religion into it. It's bringing a shallow conception of religion into the public square. And so I think what both Stout and Rorty agree on is that if we can somehow provide sound religious reason in public conversations, that we actually might have productive dialogue when it comes to these public issues, where there might be difference between, say, a religious person and another religious person who comes from a different sect or background, or a religious and a non-religious person.
Yeah, so there is illegitimate use of religion in the public square, which would be to impose some kind of dogma as the law of the land. I mean, that's theocracy. So that is illegitimate, but not because it's religion. You know, in the realm of public questions, there is an overlap between theological questions and claims and political questions and claims. And the common ground for me is human flourishing, and what are human beings for, and what is the ground of our hope, and what do we want our future to be, and towards what do we point? And so it seems to me that theology and religion in public conversations is helpful. I don't know if I really want to say this, but I'm going to say it. To the degree that they shed light on what human beings are and what our aspirations ought to be.
I'm gonna say a couple things here. First of all, stop stealing my thunder, because we are building towards this in the course, and I want to be able to talk about it and treat it in turn when we come there. But a little teaser, and I think this is really important, because I think you're saying something with which I do not disagree, but I think it's really important to sort of ground what you're saying in the context of this class, where I have some religious students and some very, very anti-religious students who think. And one of my students just today has identified as an extremist, and he really just doesn't, he has no faith in religion. So I have these people in class, and what I'm finding, and this gets us to a very S1 kind of conversation, because you and I often talk about how the S1 project sometimes has two modes of thinking. One is theological and religious. But the other that sort of, I think, undergirds that and that can also bring us together is ethical and moral. And so what I will ultimately be sort of engaging the students with is what can unify these two sides that make it palatable for us to be able to have public conversations that involve religion, where religion can be informed by some vision of the human flourishing, but the non-religious can also be informed by some vision of human flourishing. But what my task is in the course over the last couple of weeks of the course, because just as a reminder for a listening audience, it's a quarter-based class as opposed to a semester. What I'm building to is finding some ethical, moral framework that we can all get behind, regardless of whether we're religious or not. But I definitely agree with you that one thing that the religious can give us, because it's often grounded in ethical and moral frameworks, is some language about what it means to be a good person, and not only a good person, but a good person who's living a good life.
And that's consistent with a orthodox, robust Christian theology, which will not see salvation achieved through the political realm. So to put limits on what can be accomplished in politics in terms of salvation, in terms of the ultimate end of human beings, that's not something that human beings, from a Christian theological perspective, that's not something that happens in politics.
Well, that's correct. And I think that actually serves to return us to the conversation we had in the first week about what is the public square and what ails it. I think people are very, my students are very in tune with the very, very apparent limitations of politics to solve our problems, our societal problems. And I don't even just mean Kamala Harris versus Donald Trump and whether democracy survives. I mean the very big existential problems of our time. If you assume they are existential problems, climate change, wars across the globe, and I can name more, but does politics, can it really help us? Can it help us get there? And I think students are recognizing that it doesn't and are looking for something to replace it. Or if not replace it, at least make our experience with the political more productive.
Yeah, I used to think replace. I think I used to think in terms of replacement, but I feel like more and more it's reclaiming the proper role of politics which is to consider these big questions. But politics as a sphere of human endeavor needs the moral, ethical, and the theological in order to be able to ask the deeper questions and consider them so that the polis can consider them. Otherwise, politics just becomes what we have now, which is who gets the power and who can hold on to it without any vision of what getting and holding power is for. And so to me, there's this interplay between the theological and the religious and the political that we've messed up, but it's easy to mess up because we're human.
Well, that's right. And I think one thing that that does give me a lot of hope through teaching this class is that I think one of the things that I have observed over the last 10 and maybe even 20 years is maybe we were not so often aware that our politics of the last half century or quarter century is without this ethical and moral dimension. And maybe one advantage, if there's one small ray of hope of things being as bad as they are, is that people are turning now to ask the question, is this really the best we can do? Can we not do better? And what is it that's going to help us do that better? And I think, you know, being able not only to discuss religion in the public square, but to use these ethical and moral frameworks that come from different religious backgrounds and non-religious backgrounds as well as a starting point to reclaim, to use your words, is giving the students a lot of hope, and me too.
Well, it's interesting because I think part of what it drives, there are some people for whom politics has become sacralized. Their political identity is like a religious identity. And that is dangerous because it can drive violence. But it points to some kind of misalignment of the ultimate questions that usually have fallen theologically, or at least in moral philosophy, theology, a misalignment with those ultimate questions, and then the penultimate, which is our political life, which is why we need better theology in the public square. We don't need to eliminate it. We need better theology, and better theology understands what you just said, which is the texts themselves are contested, and the texts themselves invite conversation, invite questioning, and invite democratic dialogue.
Well said. Well said, my friend.
Any teaser you want to give for week four when we come back and talk again?
Well, essentially tees up what we do in week four, which is to look at the concept of religious literacy. And again, I gave them two scholars to put in conversation with one another. Stephen Prothero, who is a scholar at Boston University, who's written a book about religious literacy, What Every American Needs to Know, ... and Doesn't. And a colleague of mine, Diane Moore at Harvard Divinity School, who has a different conception of religious literacy. And just to continue connecting the dots back to the larger course arc, if in week three, the normative question is, what should be the role? Then the purpose of week four is really to ask ourselves, does this concept of religious literacy get us any closer? And so we'll talk about that next week.
I love your course design. I feel like when I hear you talk about this arc that you've created, I can get inside it and I can see where it's going. And it's almost like getting a brochure. It's like, oh yeah, I would love to go there and there, and I would love to take the extra tour down that path. I'm appreciative of the thoughtfulness with which you've put together this course.
Well, to our listening audience and to you and to others who I hope someday get the opportunity to do this, all aboard.
Great.